The magic has begun.
I love magic.
Yeah. Doesn't everybody? Doesn't everybody?
What is it? I think it's Arthur C. Clarke. Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Does that mean that there's no such thing as magic?
Well, okay, and a strictly, I mean, if you want to get theological, I would say no, because I think, well...
Interesting.
Right, I mean, so in the first place I immediately go to this is, I did a couple mission trips in Haiti, and there is voodoo down there.
Mm-hmm.
And
does it work?
Well, I will put it this way. So I don't know, right? I am fearful of it, as any God-fearing person should be, because that is the devil's work. So that is my stance on that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I think magic is real insofar as it's just the power of demons, right?
Like, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's neat. What's Haiti like?
Haiti is both beautiful and a mess all at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, you know, this is now me being a decade removed from being down there. So I was down there in 2010 and 2011.
I don't think much has changed.
And something I don't talk about a lot, cause I just, not for any particular reason, but just, you know, I'm not here to grandstand, but I was down there during the earthquake. We were, you know, not obviously because of it, because we didn't know it was coming. And
right.
We were there for a couple of days, and we had been made aware of the fact that, you know, because it's Haiti's right on a couple of tectonic zones to the north and to the west, I think. And so it's not unusual for them to get tectonic activity. Being from the northwest, where we are like basically the highest risk location in the continental United States for like catastrophic earthquakes, very familiar with being prepared for earthquakes, even though I've only been in, you know, one up until then. So, you know, they had sort of told us, you know, yeah, you might feel some an earthquake, you know, don't worry about it. So we were on the north side of Haiti. So we felt it. It was similar to the Nisqually earthquake in Seattle, give or take, from, I think it was like 2001. And so we just didn't think anything of it, because, you know, that was sort of normal. And it wasn't until probably 3 or 4 hours later where, the missionaries who we were working with sort of said, you know, came in and said, hey, this is what's happened, because they didn't know either. That was I learned a lot on that trip. I learned a lot about what the American experience of mission trips is, and more specifically, mm-hmm. isn't. It was very fascinating for a lot of reasons.
I think you mentioned like the American experience of mission trips. I think that there is a lot to be said on that. Especially this kind of like whitewashing sort of thing we do to mission trips. And I mean that in the classical sense, not in the modern like racial social justice way, but like we clean it up so much, you know. There's a day where we go into some little village and give people like some food or something, or like help them clean up trash or paint a house. But then the rest of the time we're at some fun summer camp and we're, you know, oh, we're whitewater rafting in Costa Rica. What a great missions trip.
Well, so my experience with missions.
That was my experience growing up.
Which sounds more fun than mine. I guess for the mission. So the experience I had on missions trips for the church, at least up until then, was so I grew up Presbyterian. And so our church would go down to Mexico, every year for spring break as high schoolers. And we would go build houses down there. And it was actually kind of cool to see, you know, to be able to put up an entire house. And we would literally put up 20, about 20 houses in a week.
Wow.
I mean, we legitimately, at its peak, we think we had 150 people going down for, you know, any given week. And so that was my experience. I mean, there wasn't like any, I mean, you'd have like a beach day on the way back, which was literally just time between when you got back into from Tijuana, Mexico, back into San Diego before the plane took off. But that was it. My experience in Haiti was, and the thing I think I learned the most, well, one thing I learned is that you are not like, as when you go down there, you are not helping them. They are helping you. I mean, you are not the one being missioned to, essentially. They are almost essentially missioning to you, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause you're just there for, you know, a week or two. Right. And you don't live there day to day. You don't understand, you know, any of that. I don't even speak the language in Haiti.
Right.
And that was, I think one of the most interesting things I learned being down there during the earthquake is, you know, we all had this instinct of, oh, we should go into Port-au-Prince and help. And the reality is don't speak Creole, you know, or French.
Right.
Don't really have any, you know, other than like, you know, Red Cross, you know, first aid training, don't have any medical experience.
You know, no heavy equipment.
No heavy equipment. So I get that. I get there, can't speak. What am I supposed to do? And now I'm another body to feed, another body to sleep, another mouth to feed, another body to sleep. And oh, by the way, it's already a relatively dangerous place for America, you know, for people in general. And now it's an earthquake. It's like, yeah, I'm just a liability at that point.
Right. And you're
so
in the way.
I'm in the way. Absolutely. And that would, that really sucked to hear, to be honest. But I had the entire week to think about it. And Bruce, who was a missionary down there who we were working with, was spot on. He was absolutely right. And so we continued what we were doing where we were, and we got what we needed to get done. And we got a couple extra bonus days because American Airlines was not flying out of Port-au-Prince right. anymore. And we ended up having to trek across northern Haiti into Cape Haitien and got a flight on a DC-3 built in 1944 back to Florida.
That was fun.
Which was, well, I mean, so as an aerospace nerd / aerospace engineer, I mean, I was like, this is awesome. Everyone else was maybe not so much, but it was a very fascinating experience for sure.
So, excuse me. So, like thinking about Haiti, are there just places that, like, maybe we weren't meant to live? You know what I mean? Because, like, it's not just, I mean, earthquakes are bad, but they get hit with, like, the weather too, right? Like the hurricanes and whatnot. Like,
yeah, they're in hurricane.
It seems like Haiti gets literally decimated every year by something.
Yes.
And it's like, why, like, I don't know. Maybe it's a testament to the people. Maybe I'm looking at it the wrong way. It's a testament to their resilience that they're still there building a country. But it's like, man, there are places we just shouldn't live, like Death Valley. Like, you don't need to. No one needs to live there. It's OK.
Well, just think about like even like in the U.S., right? I mean, you have the, you know, large parts of the Southeast get hurricanes every year, and we still, you know, they still come back and rebuild. You know, large parts of, you know, there's large arid areas. I mean, California, I mean, Las Vegas is a perfect example. Las Vegas should not sustain life. I mean, we've made it work. So testament of engineering, I suppose, testament of human stubbornness, maybe. You know, there's always going to be places that are not hospitable, right? And it's like, because I was thinking about this, you know, we live in earthquake country. You know, not, you know, it's not as popular or as famous as maybe California is, but it's certainly dangerous. We also are at increased risk of tsunamis and landslides in the Northwest, but we still live here. You know, I think every place has downsides, and it's just a matter of, can you effectively mitigate them, and can you effectively, you know, provide it, which includes insurance, right? And that's kind of one of the things I think is interesting is that, you know, flood insurance being done federally because, you know, no sane insurance company will do flood insurance anymore. Which is maybe that's a sign that we shouldn't be building in certain places, but here we are.
Yeah, it's fascinating. You're right. It's going to be earthquakes. It's going to be hurricanes. It's going to be tornadoes.
Yeah.
It's going to be something.
it's going to be, or you're going to have, you know, the great, you know, Great Plains and, you know, irrigation issues. So you're going to have droughts,
right. Wildfires,
I mean, yeah, you pick your disaster. I'm not quite sure there's a place on Earth that doesn't, that's not going to be susceptible to it. And if there are, there's not a lot of places. And even if you did do it, what's the point? I mean, it's, yeah, I'm not quite, I mean, I love the Northwest. It's been great. I may change my tune when the earthquake comes, but
so far,
yeah, so far it's been great.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
So you're an engineer.
I'm an engineer.
What kind of engineer? You said aerospace?
I do. Yeah. So my background is electrical mechanical engineering.
Okay.
But I work in aerospace. Nice. I do electrical systems on aerospaces. So, you know, but it's aerospace.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I had a friend that did that in the Navy. He did electrical systems on jets and stuff.
Yeah.
And he picked that job because he was certain he would never have to deploy, because it's like you don't really need like this guy to do this thing everywhere. You know, like you never need this guy. There's like one over there. There's one over here. We're good. And then the guy over there, like the guy over there retired out, and then he ended up being the most qualified. And it kind of blew back in his face, because he thought, oh man, I'll never have to deploy. But it turns out he ended up having to deploy a lot, because there was no one else that could do his job.
Yeah.
So that's neat.
Yeah.
So you said you grew up Presbyterian.
Yes.
And what kind of Presbyterian?
So PCUSA.
Okay.
Went to a rather large Presbyterian church in Seattle, University Presbyterian Church. And so they're not affiliated, but they are right next to the University of Washington. So
like
huge college outreach.
For the people that don't know, PCUSA is the liberal mainline.
Yes, but I will say this, that for as liberal mainline as it is, our church was definitely on the right side of that, far right.
Yeah.
Within PCUSA.
Those exist.
Yeah.
Those exist. Yeah. Even like the ELCA, there's a lot of great conservative, faithful pastors there.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe they put it together when you said Seattle. Maybe Seattle's pretty liberal mainline.
Yeah. I don't live in Seattle anymore. For among other reasons that, but also because housing is bonkers.
I bet.
But yeah,
I live in the Southeast and housing is bonkers. So
yeah. Yeah. So grew up Presbyterian and married Lutheran. So, you know, evident that missionary dating can work, I guess.
You guys compromised and you became a Lutheran.
Exactly. Yes. You nailed it. Our joke was always when we were dating, my wife and I, when we were dating, it was, you know, if we were going to break up, it was going to be over, you know, it was over our differences in communion. Cause that was kind of one of the things that I had to sort of reconcile with is, you know, what do I believe? And
were you fairly well catechized then? Growing up?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say like the Presbyterian church has like a nothing near what the Lutheran church has. Growing up, you know, went to church, you know, I'll say almost every Sunday, you know, went to Sunday school, was in a Bible study, starting in, you know, sixth grade. And I'll put some air quotes around that. There was some studying of the Bible. It was mostly though playing Halo and drinking Dr. Pepper.
Okay. Yeah.
So, which is, you know, probably the main experience for people at that point in time. But, yeah. So, and I mean, I'd say I had that Bible study was still very good. We would often go off on these very interesting, very philosophical tangents about, you know, the meaning of life and what, you know, what do we think, you know, what do we know to be true about the Bible and things like that. And, it was definitely it was very fundamental to my growing up for sure. I mean, it was definitely a good experience for me. And I think set me up very well in life from a faith standpoint to be where I am today.
What were sort of your general beliefs I guess what I'm trying to ask is, PC USA, I don't know how they were at the time versus how they are now, but Presbyterian, obviously they were memorialist. Did you have like any kind of a strict Calvinist kind of lean, or did your church? I don't know what I'm trying to say. Like, what was the theology like? That's the question.
I mean, so one of the interesting things I didn't learn about until later was like the whole concept of like double predestination. So that's not mm-hmm. something that was like taught, at least that I was aware of, as part of like normal discourse at our church. I don't know to what extent, at least within PCUSA, they actually believe that. I think it's kind of one of those things they sort of say on the website, but then like no one takes it seriously. Potentially, I'm not entirely sure. I would say that, you know, communion is a, you know, is, you know, do this in remembrance of me. So it's a remembrance thing. It's not a sacrament. It's, you know, don't believe it. You know, they don't baptize babies. So I was dedicated and didn't get baptized until I was an adult, which this is actually a really sad and funny story at the same time. I was a Bible study leader. So this is post college. I was just sort of like, you know, I wasn't like, oh, I don't need to get baptized, but I wasn't necessarily like in a hurry to do it. Cause it, I don't know, it didn't seem all terribly relevant based on like what I had read in the Bible. And so I was like, what had happened was, I know what it was. I was going to become a member of the church. And they're like, when were you baptized? I was like, I don't think I was. And like, this was like 2 weeks before I was supposed to become a member of the church. And like, you got to get baptized. And so I ended up getting baptized actually on my birthday.
Oh, cool.
Which was kind of fun. And then became like a Lutheran like 2 years later. yeah, obviously.
Look at that. Baptism works.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's just, it was a very, yeah, I'm not really quite sure how I would, I mean, so I grew up Presbyterian. I went off to college. I went to college in Colorado. Kind of fumbled around a bit in terms of like finding a church out there. There were some Presbyterian churches nearby, but they smelled of old people is how I would put it. Kind of bounced around between some, like, I think I even went to like a Baptist church once and like a non-denominational church and some other churches, and just like never really found a good home in Colorado, probably until like I think my senior year, where I ended up going to like a non-denominational church like 45 minutes away that was what we'd call a mega church, right? And so definitely very much like a rock band component, absolutely. But like the pastor actually was really good, and like he had like, I had this great conversation with him about tithing, because I was like, I don't have any money, I'm a college student, why should I start tithing now? And he's like, you need to tithe, period, end of story. And I started, and I did, and I still do to this day. So like, I mean, he definitely instilled some really good theological principles in me. But coming back to Seattle then, and kind of, you know, I kind of fell back into, you know, going to, you know, University Press, you know, UPC. I'll be honest, I dabbled a little bit with Mars Hill, which was still a thing at the time.
That's
Mars Hill. So that's Mark Driscoll.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You know, I think that he got, I want to be careful about how I say this. He has some very important points that I think that he made, but I think that he overall was a very, I'm going to say, dangerous pastor. And I ended up not going. I mean, I went to the church a couple times and did not feel like that was an appropriate place to be. And then we kind of saw what happened after that. So I think that's bullet dodge there for me. But also gave me, but I think it did give me a really good insight into, you know, where was I at in my faith with UPC, and like feeling like I kind of, not like, I don't know, it almost felt like I kind of like topped out with what I was being able to learn, and you know, how I was able to progress in my faith there. And I was looking for something more, which is why I was looking at places like Mars Hill. and then started dating this, wonderful woman who eventually became my wife. And she's like, "You must become Lutheran." I was like, "We'll talk about it." And so we found a really good church, a really good Lutheran church in Seattle, that wasn't too far away, which was incredibly fortunate that we found such a good Lutheran church in such a liberal city. And we've been there, basically ever since, minus a 2-year stint that we had internationally, where we were living in the UK. But we're able to find a ELCE church, which is Evangelical Lutheran Church of England, that is in fellowship with LCMS. It was an hour away, but we would drive there almost every weekend. Turned out
How
okay.
did you and your wife meet?
So, this is a good story. So we met as interns in 2006, and we were aware of each other. We were sort of working the same, same similar program, same team, not same team, but similar program. And all the interns, there's only like half a dozen interns where we were, so we all sort of got lunch, once a week or something. Went our separate ways. 5 years later, I graduated, she graduated. She's living in Montana. I was living in Seattle. And on April 1st, I get a email in my inbox. It's a flex match from eHarmony. And a flex match is basically where, you set some criteria, that you go do all the stuff, and then, there's some things that you like get a pick, some criteria you get a pick. And one of my criteria was, what range, how far away did I want to date someone? And I had picked the smallest circle possible, which was 25 miles, because I didn't want to do long distance dating. And then eHarmony says, "Hey, look, there's a flex match. They don't meet this criteria, but we think this person's great, even though they live 600 miles away." And I'm looking at this picture, I'm like going, "I know this person from somewhere." And it took me like 5 or 10 minutes. And I figured it out. It's like, "Oh, this is Rachel, from our internship." So we started chatting. This was actually, so this is 2011. So I actually, at the time, the way eHarmony worked is you would like sort of progress through these, and it probably still works the same way, but you kind of progress through these, they called it guided communication. So you would, the first steps of communication are you basically, I get a pick, like question, from a list of questions, I get a pick the questions I want to send, and then she gets to pick answers, from a set of answers to those questions. So it's like this very sort of, multiple choice kind of thing. And then it kind of expands to, I get to pick questions from a list. She gets to put like one sentence answers in, and it goes both ways. Like, she gets to pick and then I answer. And then it goes to sort of more open-ended questions where I get to pick these questions and she gets to write like a paragraph. And it goes to like more open, fully open communication, which is you can write whatever you want. And so this was April 1st, and I was going back to Haiti in like 2 weeks. And I'm like going, I got to get to the end of this sort of, I got to get to open communication so I can let her know I'm going to be away from the computer for 2 weeks. And I think we got there like the day before I left to go to Haiti. And I was like, "Hey, is this Rachel? Are you the intern from 2006?" Knowing full well I know who she is at this point, because I've stalked the crap out of her, which I can say now because she had
It
stalked the
worked
crap out
out.
of
It
me.
all
Well,
worked
not
out.
only did it work out, but she had stalked the crap out of me too. So, this is like, so this is before, this is like in the midst of Facebook becoming a little bit too creepy, I think, maybe. So it's all still good. It's like, "Hey, I'd love to talk to you more. I'm going to be on a mission trip in Haiti. Hope to talk to you when I get back. See you later." And that was it. And so we talked when we got back, and we talked through all of May. Started planning like a visit, I think, in June. And so she came up to Seattle in June, or sorry, in July, 4th of July. I was going to go out to Montana at the end of August for, they had like a state fair. And then we decided, but that was going to be like 8 weeks away. And so we decided we didn't want to wait that long. So we each drove halfway, which, as it turns out, is still in Montana. No joke. And we went camping. And then I think we actually talked even about getting married then. So this is like through, this is like we'd like met each other. This is like our second like in-person meeting, and we were already talking about like we like yeah, very much like this was it, right? And then yeah,
it's so cute.
It is. It's a great story. It's definitely been, you know, marriage is not an easy thing, but I'm not. I you know, there's no one else who I'd rather do life with. I mean, life is hard.
And so I don't know how people do it alone. I really don't.
Yeah. Well, I think you can do it alone. I don't know. I think. Yeah, that has its own challenges that I would not be. I think you're right. I think, you know, for as much as being married can be challenging, because I think life is challenging in general, but I think doing it alone is even more hard.
Yeah. How did you guys work the? Because as I'm understanding, you're like, you've always been very faithful. So how did we work the faith thing?
Yeah. So it was kind of a. So I did adult catechism with Pastor Lastman, who's since retired. And it was actually, so we had this adult information class that he did. And it was like a 12-week thing. And, you know, I had a lot of the basics down, right? I mean, there's a lot of things that don't change between denominations. And I think that it kind of came down to the, you know, how much does, you know, is this something that I can honestly believe in? You know, sort of like the difference is like, do I honestly have an issue? You know, can I honestly believe in, because it wouldn't be, it's not transcendentalism, but, or not, transubstantiation. I think they call it, I think it's called something else, but it's transubstantiation essentially with the communion. Like, okay. Do I have an issue with that? I think that, and the answer is no, because I got into this really great conversation with him about, I think, a couple things. And it kind of boiled, I think the two things that I think were really pivotal in that conversation was, the Bible says it's true. You kind of have to take that on faith. And that's kind of the foundation of what, in many ways, what Christianity is, right? It's that you have to accept that it is what it is, what it says it is. And if you don't, then nothing really matters, because at that point you are applying your own, you know, lived experience onto what the Bible says, instead of letting the Bible speak into your life.
Wow, yeah.
And that was huge, wow. Right? So there's that. And then the other thing, which I've come to greatly appreciate as a Christian and as a Lutheran, and also ironically, maybe even as an engineer, is it's okay not to know. And I think that's one of the things that Lutherans get really, really, that they sort of do really well, is that they'll be like, look, we don't know. The Bible says this. We don't know why. We don't know how, but this is what it is. And that's what we're doing. So we don't know how, you know, the mystery of, you know, the mystery of communion, right? The mystery of how that all works. And we're okay with letting that be like that. And, you know, I think that is where a lot of other denominations kind of go wrong, is they feel like they have to have an absolute answer to things.
Yeah. And it's got to all make sense.
It has to all make sense. And the reality is that the world doesn't make, I mean, we are a sinful world, and it's not going to make sense for a variety of reasons. Yeah. I also think that if you sort of take a little bit bigger picture, I think that there's a lie essentially about in life that everything has an answer, and that there's always these absolutes about things. You know, you think about, and science has not helped in the last few decades with this. I think science has tried to help by trying to make science more approachable, but I think they went a little bit askew with sort of saying things are absolutes, even though scientists know that things aren't absolutes, right? It's the data up to this point has shown that ... right? Everything's a theory until proven otherwise. It's the theory of gravity. Gravity is remarkably consistent, but there are still questions about, you know, I was just, you know, is gravity consistent through time, right? That's an outstanding question. And there's some really cool research that they do to sort of try and show if that is or isn't true. And, you know, part of what makes gravity hard to research is that gravity is one of the, I think it's actually like the weakest force that we have, right? I mean, and the easiest way you can do this is, you know, take a magnet, take a paperclip, hold, you know, put the paperclip underneath the magnet, and the paperclip's going to stay there. Because for as big as the Earth is, that gravity still can't pull that item down. The magnetic right. force is still significant, orders of, like, it's something like, I don't know, don't quote me on this, it's like 10 to the 20 times more powerful. It's like just ridiculous. So, but there's some cool experiments that they're doing to look at, you know, how might gravity be changing across time? How might gravity be changing across space? Is gravity the same here as it is there? And not just like, like when you, because like when you go up higher, you're farther away, right? So the effect of gravity is less. So not that. This is like, does the fundamental value of gravity, G, does that change depending on where you're located?
Hmm.
So, yeah. So.
Well, and God, this is not my area at all.
Nor is it mine, but we can talk about
like,
it.
How do you even measure the effect of time on gravity? Like I know there's probably some nifty experiments you can do, but like at the end of the day, I feel like what you really need is either some kind of recoverable probe into a black hole or mm-hmm. a time machine.
Yeah.
And both of those things just do not exist.
Yeah. So,
right.
Yeah. And so my layman understanding of this is there's a couple things they can do. So one of them is scientific experiments, which is, and we have, I think, you know, 200 years worth of scientific experiments, which is a drop in the bucket. So not really great, especially given the error bars that we have around gravity. The other one, though, is you can look back in time, because we do actually have a time machine, as it turns out, is because when you look using telescopes back to, you know, and as the universe expands,
right.
And things redshift, you're effectively looking back in time the more red you go.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can look. So there are I think the challenge I would say, and again, this is me as a layman, is that that's purely observational. So we can observe these things. But the important element on the other side of the scientific process is testability. Can you go test it?
Right.
So and that's where I don't know how they do that. Right. And that's going to be the challenge with things like gravity is how do you go test something like that where, you know, if it really is something that is change that does change, but it changes so slowly on the order of, you know, eons, how can you go test that? And I'm not quite sure you're going to be able to do that. So I don't know. That's for people smarter than me to go figure out.
Bro, same.
Yeah.
So since we kind of hooked into science here, I want to pick your engineer brain a little bit. Talking about redshift and distant light, how old do you think the universe is?
Yeah. Okay. This is a great question. I have two answers. Yeah.
Okay.
So my answer is it doesn't, I'm not quite sure it matters.
Okay.
And then my second answer, it's somewhere between 6,000 and 13.7 billion. So
that's great.
And here's why. It's because this I had to wrestle with this. This is actually a really salient point, though, because I had to wrestle with this. Because growing up, like Presbyterian, I don't think Presbyterians have like an official stance on the age of the universe, right? Lutherans right. do, though.
Do we?
I think it's 6,000 years, I think. I think that's what it's...
Yeah. Well, so most of the Lutherans I bump into are somewhere between 6 and 10. I personally go with like 3,500 like just to make people upset.
I'm not quite sure it necessarily makes a difference, though. And it's one of those things where I don't know. And I can say that because, I have the Bible that says one thing, and that's very important. So I trust that. There's this interesting data that appears to be in conflict. But I also know that we're discovering new things all the time. So this is one of those places where there's a mystery here that I'm allowing that to sort of be open. I'm allowing both of those to exist open-handed, you know, with my hands open saying, you know, it could be either. And I honestly legitimately think that. That might surprise a lot of people, I think. But I think that, you know, that's a really good way to look at a lot of this. And it really puts a lot of things into perspective about, you know, what is it that we know to be true? And right. why do we think that? Because there's a lot of things that people say are true, but aren't. I mean, how many, you know, the whole thing about like, eating spinach, right? I think that's like a misplaced decimal in someone's research paper, and we believe that to be true for how many decades?
Right.
Carrots, you know, being good for your eyesight, that was a British ploy to basically cover up, as I understand it, was basically to cover up their ability, you know, their radar. It was basically just to hide the fact they had radar as they started printing all this propaganda that eat carrots so you can see better in the night. So that the Germans wouldn't know that they had this other thing that could see
right.
in the night. So, yeah, I mean, you kind of got to go test everything, you know, which is
right.
what the Bible says. So, I'm a firm fan of testing everything.
That's wild. I think it's interesting, because I don't think it matters necessarily. The age of the universe. To me, it makes a lot of sense that if God created a mature creation, it would make sense to me that the universe would appear to be 18 billion years old, because it's created in a state of maturity. So of course it would appear that way. And when we measure it, those are the measurements we come up with. Like, that makes sense to me. That seems very probable.
Mm-hmm.
And we can even, there's even some scriptural proof for this, where Jesus is a guy that's blind from birth, and Jesus heals him. And the guy says, "I see men walking around like trees." And so then Jesus does the thing, and then his eyesight is fully restored. And the big question that you have to ask yourself is, how does he know what trees look like?
Yeah.
Because he's been blind his whole life, right? But it's because Jesus, the healing is complete. The guy that Peter heals, that gets up and starts dancing,
yeah,
and leaping about, right? So he didn't, when God heals somebody, he doesn't just give them the ability to walk. He also forms all the neural connections that you need to have muscle memory and coordination, as if you always could have walked.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
It's complete.
Absolutely. Yes.
It's complete. And so I think that probably says something about creation. I don't know. But I think maybe when it comes to things like the age of the universe, you can very easily fall into sin when you start to try and disprove,
yes,
God on something, right? Where you're like, "Oh, well, you said 6 days, but I can prove that," right? So then, like, at that point,
but you can't prove. That's the thing. This
no,
goes
that,
back
yeah,
to,
no, no one, no one was there.
Well, yeah, no one was there. And how do you test that, right? Because that's part of what you have to have. I mean, people don't understand or forget what the scientific process is, and part of it requires that you go test it. If you can't mm-hmm. test, this has been part of the issue with string theory, is that at least originally, and I don't know where the state of string theory is now, but you know, back when, like, it's probably 10 years when Brian Greene was sort of all the rage, and I mean he's a great physicist, I'm not trying to discount him, but part of the issue with a lot of parts of string theory is that you could never go prove it, and they kind of came out and said that it's like, look, this is a crazy theory, and we're not going to be able to prove it. So they kind of shrugged and kind of left it on the shelf like that.
It's interesting to me that a lot of stuff like that, that we would consider hard science, physics, mathematics, a lot of that stuff sort of backs around into philosophy eventually, which I find fascinating. Like, there's a whole study of mathematics that's literally just philosophical implications of mathematics, not actually math, right?
Yes.
Like the idea that there must necessarily be twice as many even numbers as there are odd numbers.
Oh,
because
yeah.
if you double any number, it's an even number, which means there have to be more even numbers than odd numbers.
Yes.
But that's not like a thing, because for any even number, the number before it must be an odd number, right? So Here we are taking something that's repeatable and testable and scientific, and we've backed around into philosophy just with implication. I think that's beautiful. And I think it shows really that philosophy and theology and things like that are just so important to us as humans, right? Like, it's sort of baked in.
I would even go farther, and I would say, I think it actually shows our shortcomings and understanding how powerful God is.
Mm.
Because if we are so focused on and so constrained in our thinking, kind of, you know, to your earlier example about, the man who was healed, to not even think to consider that God would not just heal him in the traditional way that we tend to think of healing in modern day, but that, you know, that when he was restored fully as if it had never happened. You know, what does that say about our own limits that we put on God, right? We are limiting why are we limiting what God can do in that thought experiment? Well, not thought experiment. But when we think about those things, why do we do that? And I think that once I try to sort of think past that and sort of accept that as true and not worry about it, that's been, I mean, in some ways, just remarkably freeing.
Yeah. Yeah, there's there's a lot to, and I know this is going to annoy actual philosophy people to death, and so I'm very sorry, but I know. bunch of ivory tower losers, what they are. No, but the people say, you know, oh, is can God make a rock so heavy that he couldn't lift it? Well, yeah, sure, he could. He could make a rock so heavy that he couldn't lift it, but also he could probably still lift it anyway, because the properties of the rock, i.e. it's so heavy God can't even lift it, don't dictate the properties of God, which is that he's God and he can do anything he wants. And if he wants to make a rock so heavy that he couldn't lift it, I'm sure he could do that. And then if he decided he wanted to lift that rock, I'm sure it wouldn't be a problem.
Exactly.
Because it's God. And
exactly. That's no, you are that is absolutely. And you're correct. I think you're 100% correct with that, because we are, you know, we tend to think of God as, I think at least, we often will think of God as someone who lives within the bounded constraints of the universe that we are in, right? You know, bounded by the three dimensions of our physical space and the fourth dimension of time. It's like, you know, must have all these things. Like, why would we even think that? That God exists outside of all of that.
Instead of recognizing that we are made in God's image, we often try and remake God in our own image.
Yes.
Right?
Absolutely.
And that's, that's the problem. It's he's God. And at the end of the day, so I just filmed a collab with the guy from the Christian Combatives YouTube channel, and we were reviewing atheist memes. And one of the memes, it was great. One of the memes, it talked about like how God is evil because he like allows famine and death and, you know, genocides and all these things. And aside from all of the various theological points you can make, the good reverend made just a great point that at the end of the day, God is the creator of all things. And if he wants to move someone from this side of eternity to that, it is his prerogative to do so.
Right.
And it's not within your ability. I mean, you have the ability, but it's not within your scope, your purview to question that, because you're not the creator.
Correct.
Right? And these things are hard and they're difficult. And, you know, there's the meme, oh, you just say God works in mysterious ways whenever you don't understand it. But that's the truth, though, is sometimes God does work in mysterious ways. And I don't always know why God allows things to happen, but I do know that at the end of the day, he works all things for the good of those who believe.
Yeah. I mean, amen is what I'll just say to that.
Yeah. Yeah. So wild. So tracking way back earlier to you and your wife and you're going and joining the LCMS church. So from what I get out of this beautiful little love story is that you just immediately started attending LCMS churches with her, or Lutheran churches in general with her.
Yeah. Yes.
It just sort of just rolled right over on that.
It did. Yeah. I mean, this was brewing. Yeah. This was a brewing thing. I mean, I was already I had been back at UPC because it was sort of like, that's where I'd gone before. So I didn't know what else to do. And it's better to be someplace than not someplace, I think.
Yeah.
Sort of tangential to kind of all of this relationship story unfolding, there was also some changes that had been going on within the church, within UPC as well, that I don't want to say I left because of them, but it didn't make it harder to leave. Which I think, you know, there was some drama around some pastors and you know, how that had kind of played out. And for me, the takeaway of that was that there are, I think big churches can be good in some ways. I think they can also be dangerous. And I think that especially when you start thinking about like the amount of funding that churches need, the larger they get and who end up you know, who ends up contributing, and how that can sometimes work in ways that aren't always great. Definitely looking for a smaller church was, you know, having coming into a smaller church was great. And getting to a place where there weren't as many, I don't know, political influences, I guess, for lack of a better term, was good. So it wasn't like, I mean, I would have stayed, and things would have been, you know, fine had I not met Rachel. But I think it was a good, there's a lot of things that were pushing me away into LCMS. And I would, you know, I don't know if that's God leading or just sort of dumb luck. I will tend to err towards God leading, because I think that we tend to not credit God enough.
100% cosign. I was reading a biography of George Washington. Probably a decade ago, I read a biography of Washington. It was right at 2013. It was the year I got married.
Hey, it's a good year. It's the year I got married.
Nice. We got married in August.
We
So,
beat you by 2 months.
oh, dang. Okay. Well, you know, great. But they included a lot of his letters to his wife when he was out and like doing, you know, things. A lot of his letters to family members and friends and all this. And especially during the conflict with the Native Americans, there were a lot of conflicts that he went to and was a military leader in these things. And there are so many references in his letters to, you know, to God, but it's not, he doesn't say, you know, oh, our Lord Jesus Christ. And so people don't realize, but like, he'll talk about like, oh, there was a raid today, and they, you know, they destroyed this and that, but thankfully none of the men were hurt, and the hand of providence kept them from destroying our food, right? And that's the hand of providence, that's God, right? And that's what he's talking about. And there was this old way that we used to, instead of crediting things to luck, we credited them to providence with a capital P, which is the sort of the guiding hand of God in all things. And we've lost that.
I will say here, and I guess here's the, you know, the issue, the concern I have is that, you know, there are people who will say so and so, or God said, or, you know, whatever, right? And it's like, how do you then go and sort of distill out what is or what isn't? And I don't, you know, I don't have a great answer. I don't have a great answer. And I really struggle with that, because I see people all around who will say something, you know, God told them to do this, or God said this, or, you know, prosperity gospel, God forbid. You know, it's all the, and it's, I don't know, it makes me really uncomfortable, I guess, to be honest, to
Well,
sometimes credit God, because I see this sort of false flag everywhere else around me, and I'm like, that's not it. And then the other hand is, I also don't know what God said. I mean, I don't know, you know, I can't prove it, right? That's the other thing. And maybe that's sort of the engineer in me not being comfortable with some of that, and maybe that's just what I need to let go of. But I really do try, and you know, when I look at something and be like, look, the probability of this, and I think this is kind of what miracles are about too, is, you know, the definition of a miracle is, despite probability, this still happened. It's and so from, you know, when you kind of sort of rephrase it that way, you know, part of the miracle is that you didn't think it was supposed to happen, and yet it did.
Wow, yeah. I think regards the providence and whatnot, I think if something goes well, it's I credit God. And if something goes poorly, I blame myself. And
But is that,
I think
is that
that's
healthy
the
though? I mean, is that,
yeah, I think so.
but if something goes poorly, is it, it's not necessarily your fault though.
No, well, okay, so I don't always blame myself personally, but if something goes well, if I get a raise at work or I'm, you know, whatever, like this whole the stimulus checks and all this, when they happened, I had just gotten a really good job. I wasn't in any danger of losing this job. My wife had just gotten a promotion, and we had a plan to start paying off our debt. And then we start getting stimulus money that we literally didn't need, and we use that to accelerate paying off debt and getting debt-free, right? Yeah. And so that's something where I would say, well, that's God right there working through this pandemic and these presidents and all this stuff to help us when we need it, where we need it, how we need it, whatever. If I have a plan to do something and for whatever reason it falls through, or something doesn't go as intended, it goes poorly, my car breaks down or something like that, I'm going to blame like the sinful world. It's not God's fault my car broke down. But if my car broke down and then like 20 minutes later there was an accident wherever I was getting ready to be, well, then now I'm ready to move the car breaking down back into the God's providence column, because it was inconvenient at the time, but it saved me literally from, you know, this accident or whatever, you know. So it's, I don't know, I'm willing to be wishy-washy on it. And if it's good, I'm willing to give God the credit, because I know at the end of the day, I'm not going to get up to heaven and he's going to be like, hey, you gave me credit for this good thing that wasn't actually me. You know, and it's like, oh, sorry, I trusted you too much. I don't know.
Yeah. No, I would go with you on that.
So, I'm always, I grew up Pentecostal, so I'm always very iffy when people say God told me to XYZ. I'm always like, are you sure?
Everything.
Whenever someone says, oh, the Lord just told me, and then they start saying something, I always say, can I write this in the back of my Bible? Can I add this to my Bible?
That's nice.
They get very uncomfortable, and they say, well, no, you can't. You say, well, God told you, so it's inspired, so it's Holy Scripture.
Yes.
And then they start to say, oh, well, no, it's like different than that.
Yeah, how? Well, I just was looking up the verse. Yeah, so like 1 Thessalonians 5. So rejoice always, pray continually, give thanks in all circumstances, for this is God's will for you in Jesus Christ. I mean, I think that kind of sums up what you're saying right there about always give him credit. And then I like the next part too, which is do not quench the spirit, which I think is probably what I need to take away from that, to give him, you know, to praise, you know, rejoice always. And do not treat prophecies with contempt, but test them all and hold on to what is good. Reject every kind of evil. And I think that's I mean, I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's certainly a discussion when it comes to the God told me to tell you types. It's certainly.
Yeah. I'm going to use that. I'm going to use. I like that. Can I write it in the back of my Bible?
Yep.
Better yet, will you write it in the back of my Bible?
Yeah, exactly. Let's add this to Scripture right now.
Yeah.
Yep. It's God breathed, right? So. Yeah, it's a good one. It's a good one. It's kind of devastating. I've used it on family members before, which made for some awkward dinners. But you know,
I'm always up for a good pot stirring. That's what makes life interesting, I think. Sometimes.
It is. Yep. I live to stir. I live to stir the pot.
Yes.
Much to my wife's consternation, she's not very happy about that, but. You know, is what it is. That's awesome. Andrew, thank you so much for coming and hanging out, man.
Yeah, I'm glad we got this to talk about some cool stuff.
I really want to have you back on. Feel free to veto this or not.
Oh, no, I'd love to come back on.
Oh, great.
I also wish we lived closer, too, because I would love to hang out with you in person.
Yeah,
Which is like, I mean, I think that's like the blessing and the curse of like, Lutheran Twitter right now is that like I've met absolutely amazing people
nowhere near
that are nowhere near me exactly and it's like who Same. what Lutheran in the right mind is going to move to Seattle too,
and here's the curse of it all too, is like there's none of them there where you're at in the PNW, and there's none of them here where I'm at in the Southeast, but all of them like live in like St. Louis together, like in like one little area, they're all within like 45 minutes of each other. And like, I feel like sometimes I'm like the only guy that's like, you know, not there. Yeah, there you go. like a distance Lutheran club.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to have you on to debunk scientific based atheist memes.
Yeah, that would be fun. I think that would be fun. We're gonna have to do that on a day when I'm not cranky, because I get really cranky really fast. Like I can't even look at like the Reddit "Are atheists any like at all?" Like
no.
I don't know if they're like just doing it for the trolls and the lols, because like if you like, yeah, do they really believe this? It's just like it blows my mind sometimes.
Yeah,
but I think we could probably find some good ones to talk about that would be worth talking about.
Sometimes I'll be on like, I'll browse through like ex-Christian on Reddit, which is like a support group, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm like, man, 90% of y'all, your problem is that you were never actually catechized.
Yeah.
I can't believe Christians believe XYZ. Newsflash. We don't.
Yeah.
We don't believe that thing. Yeah. That is terrible. I agree with you.
Or that they were some, you know, they were traumatized by the church, which is absolutely valid, right? I mean, that's been a real problem. That
yes,
it's so sad, but yeah,
it is. But a lot of people, though, they just, I don't know. I feel like a lot of people are like, look, if God really loved me, he'd let me do meth, you know, or whatever, you know. Like that's okay. That's the real the underlying thing is at the end of the day it's like a porn addiction or something that they don't want to give up, you know. Here's the thing is I would love to keep being a Christian, but I really want to move in with my girlfriend, so God must not be real.
Isn't that like what Luther was saying when he said, you know, if you're gonna sin boldly?
Moving in with your girlfriend, maybe not.
Taking out of context, you know. I'm pretty sure that's what you meant, right?
That's what the Catholics say. Like whenever they quote Luther, it's that one quote out of context every time. That's great. Andrew, is there anything I can plug for you? You want people to follow you on Twitter?
Yeah, follow me on Twitter. There's two things I would plug. One of them is going to be selfish. The other one, not so much. So the selfish one first is I have this little side hustle called Dial a Podcast.
That's you?
That's me.
What?
Yeah. I thought I told you this. Okay. Yeah.
No.
That's me. It was, it's something I kind of started as sort of like we had been doing something similar at our church. And I was like, I bet other churches would want this, but I also know that like churches don't actually have like the technology staff or resources to do it. Can I do this really easy, make it cost effective? You know, so it's not about making money. It's about, you know, can I do this at a level where, and offer it at a level where I don't lose too much, that I don't lose money on it. And I make just a little bit to sort of cover my time to do it. So dialupodcast.com is really targeted at churches who have sermons, you know, podcasts, and want to be able to, allow other members of their church who don't necessarily aren't necessarily technology savvy to be able to call in. Basically, you get a number and you just, you know, the person dials the number and they listen to your latest podcast. It's a fire and forget thing for you. You just set it up and that's it. I'll plug that. And then actually kind of going along with that, actually, which is help out at your church. Whatever church you go to, there is something that you can do. And you don't have to do it for forever. But like the church is not just the staff and the pastors, right? The church is the people of the church. And it's not even just like the elders either. I mean, it's everyone. There's always something to do. And I would say, you know, whether you're young or you're old or you're married or you're not, or you have kids or you don't, there is something that you can do. And I think that, you know, your pastor and your board would love it if you sort of thought about how you could help out, you know, from time to time with something that you find passionate and that you feel like you're good at doing and would be beneficial to the church.
Absolutely.
That's
awesome.
Yeah.
Great. I want to add on to that too, that helping out at your church could also just be like that one guy that always comes and sits by himself, you know, just like maybe get lunch with that dude.
Or even like the guy who sits up, you know, be the guy who sits in the front pew. or the second to front pew. I don't think
anyone's sing hymns obnoxiously loud.
Absolutely. No, yeah. Absolutely. I think, you know, there's a lot of ways people can help that I think that are important. And I think that for me has been a joy about being in the church, is finding some way to actually be part of the church, not just go to the church.
Yeah, absolutely. That's awesome. Andrew, thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.